It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm not afraid to speak in public. I talk into this microphone every day. I did stand-up comedy in a hostel bar in Roseburg, Oregon. They did not find me funny. But improv theater? No. I have never done improv. I'm brave. I'm not crazy. Improvisational theater is invented in the moment while the audience is watching and waiting. Improv is a proving ground. It's given us some of our favorite entertainers. It's also very American, as I learned in the new book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. The author is Sam Wasson. He has done improv. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for coming. First of all, improv is more than just improvising within a sketch. Will you define improv?
Well, I think a good way to do it is I would say improv is jumping into the unknown with another person. And the other person is an important part of this because when
sounds like life.
It is. It is. And finally, the most enlightened improvisers have made that connection and they live life as if it were an improv. That's absolutely right.
So jumping in into the unknown with another person.
So the reason why the other person, so the unknown part is pretty intuitive. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going to happen next is the unknown, and that's improvisation. But the other person part is crucial because if it's just you, you can then fall back on your own personal riffs, what you know about yourself, your own consciousness. And that doesn't take you into the unconsciousness, which is the unknown, which is where you want to be. It requires another person to throw you off your own game. So the purest improvisation is more than one person.
Into the unconscious. This is going to get psychological, too.
I like to go there. I can go there.
Good. While we're on kind of the history and the definition here, I had assumed that improv is ancient and universal. I mean, before there was paper and writing, we were entertaining each other spontaneously. How can this be an American art form?
Well, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure people were just getting up. People have been just been getting up and having a good time as long as there have been people.
Yes.
But it was not codified. It was not said officially that this is a distinct school of theater until Viola Spolin, who founded this work in Chicago in the 20s and 30s, came out and said, okay, we're doing something different here. There's a completely new rule book. And then it was her son, Paul Sills, who brought it into the Compass Theater.
And Viola didn't just spontaneously found a theater troupe. Will you tell the brief story of how this happened?
No, this did not start out as theater. I mean, the story of improvisation is itself improvised. So yes, this did not begin as improvisational theater. Viola Spolin was a social worker, and she specialized in games and in drama. And one of the ways that she got children to relate to each other was by creating these problems. That's what she called them. And they were improvisational games. And by playing these games, by diving into these problems, children began to break through their discomfort, their self-consciousness. And what makes this so American is that Viola was teaching children at Hull House. These were immigrant children of different races, different classes. They spoke different languages and came from different cultures and often didn't have the means to communicate with each other anyway. But when Viola threw them into the unknown together, they could help each other come out of it. And that, I think, is what America is when it's America.
Thrown into the unknown. Yeah. Yes, yes.
We're a work in progress, right?
You find this very American in terms of our democracy, you can think of the improvisational jazz,
and every voice comes into improvisation. I mean, if you think about an improvisational theater, an improvisational experience, even the audience is calling back at you, telling you what they want. You don't have that in the legit stage.
That's true. That is true. The audience is part of the show. Your first chapter is called We the Jews. What is Jewish about improv?
Well, I think like all comedy, it's about being marginalized, marginal groups. The Jews were more marginalized then in America than they were now. So they were
starting at about 1940.
Starting at 1940 or 50. And then my second chapter is the punks. You're thinking about Bill Murray. You're thinking about Belushi. And then we have the nerds, Colbert and Carell. Now, these groups started on the margin and then gradually, by way of comedy, actually became part of the mainstream. So much so now that we don't even think of nerd as pejorative anymore. People, they say nerd with pride.
Yes.
But these guys, they started out when nerd was almost a bad word.
And why is margin? marginalized important in theater and comedy?
In comedy, it's important because comedy is about not having power. And if you think about, you've got to be angry. You've got
to
be...
Why do you have to be angry?
Well, because comedy...
You have to be funny. Why do you have to be angry?
Well, because comedy is a problem. Comedy is saying, this is not right. That's why you're laughing. You're laughing at a discrepancy between what should be and what is. And that's often the province of someone who's unempowered.
Yeah, okay.
You're complaining about something.
Yes.
Yeah, you know?
If everything was hunky-dory, exactly. It's not interesting. No certainly not funny.
Exactly. And no rage. Therefore, no rage.
No rage.
Yeah.
It's interesting we're talking about rage because the most famous thing about improv is the idea of yes and. Where's the rage in that?
Well, it's not there. And that's why this work is so healing, especially to comedians who come in with so much rage. And that's why that's why this book ends up being a very happy story for a lot of people who start out not being happy. Because when you play with people and you support each other and you take care of each other and you yes and each other, it becomes very hard to sustain that level of anger. And that's why this work in the end can be so healing.
Well, how did yes and become the rule? Because you could also say there's comedy in conflict. You got to have conflict.
Well, no, it's an important distinction to make. Yes and isn't saying don't have conflict.
Uh-huh.
You can disagree with someone that you're improvising with, but what you can't do is undermine their reality. If they say, I love your blue jacket, you can't say, this is a red jacket.
It's a dead end.
It's an absolute dead end. And where does that scene go from there?
Yeah.
So you have to yes and their reality, which doesn't mean you have to agree with them.
You know what? There's a lot of undermining each other's realities these days. It doesn't seem like America's doing a lot of yes and.
I would agree with you.
We are a bad improv.
I would agree with you. And we have a bad improviser in chief, I would say. Yes, absolutely. We need to be a more improvisational country. Absolutely. And when we are, we're really improvising. And that's one of the messagey things about this book. That's one of the things that I think is nobler about this book and makes it more than just art and show business is that in here is really a way to live life.
Yeah, this is not just aside, an observation to you. You think that improv is what America has been doing well, and that's part of who we are?
I think when it's good, we're improvising. Yeah. Absolutely.
Again, the book is Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art, and the author is Sam Wasson. I promised some psychology. You were picking up on the unconscious and, being thrown into the unknown. You said improv is like therapy.
Yeah.
Right? How is that true for you?
Well, I felt good for the most part when I was improvising. I mean, I'm an anxious person. A lot of us are anxious people.
How does an anxious person go
get
out
to improv?
Get into improv?
Because
the scariest thing, like I told you at the top, things that other people think is scary. Improv is another planet of scary.
It
to
is
me.
Scary, and I didn't quite get over it. But you find moments when you're improvising. I mean, there are certain moments when you're improvising when no one does really catch you, and you fall on your face, and it is as horrible as it sounds. Especially if you're like me and you're not really that good. But there are, on the other hand, moments where somebody does catch you. And when you feel enough of that on stage, you begin to think, just like you said at the beginning of the show, wait, the only difference between stage and life is a platform a couple inches off the ground. If I can apply what I'm doing here to real life off stage, maybe if I do leap, someone will catch me if I'm improvising with somebody who also understands how to do this. So in time, it does build up, I hate to say it, your confidence.
You said that you're not that great at it. You're very self-deprecating, but you've interviewed a lot of famous improvisers. Did you hear that story? Does a story stand out of someone telling you how improv changed their approach to
everyone,
the rest of life?
Everyone.
Tell me a story.
Every single one. And the other thing that's so incredible about it is that, and I was talking about this with Kelly Leonard at Second City, that it's hard to think of an improviser who's not a good person. Whereas,
really?
Whereas in your field of stand-up, you have to be a bad person. In fact, I want to see a bad person when I go see stand-up. I mean, I want to see someone full of rage, consumed, angry, unhappy with... I mean, I think of stand-up comedians as the great protesters.
That's why I wasn't a better stand-up comedian. I'm too happy.
You're too nice.
I'm at peace.
Well, see, maybe you are an improviser.
Ah.
Maybe you're an improviser.
Okay. So tell me, does a story come to mind of somebody... improv changed my life?
Well, Mike Nichols was one of those guys.
Mike Nichols is a granddaddy of comedy and theater and sketch and movies. Oh my gosh. And improv too. He started out.
Yes. He is really he really is the grandfather of improvisational comedy with Elaine May. And
Nichols and May, may have heard of.
Exactly. And Nichols started out a Jewish refugee. He fled Nazi Germany when he was 8, and he had good reason to be very, very angry. And not trustful of people, and always wary, obviously. He lived in fear. And it was only through improvising with Elaine that he really started to feel, wait a second, human beings are not all Nazis. They're not all bad. They're not all out to get me. Maybe I can leap with Elaine and gradually Barbara Harris and Eugene Trubnik and everyone else in his ensemble. And it actually made Mike, it was one of the things that softened Mike.
Okay, Mike Nichols, Elaine May, those are legends of the theater and of comedy, and there are so many in this book. Obviously, you've already mentioned Bill Murray and Belushi, and more recently, Colbert and Carell. We have Saturday Night Live and Second City. I mean, the celestial pantheon, right? So here's my question. If improv is so great, how come people go from improv to sketch or to movies, to other things?
Oh.
They go to written form.
Oh, why would they leave theater?
It's like, oh yeah, I did improv back when I was a nobody. So what's so great about improv? Why isn't improv the ultimate entertainment experience? We seem to prefer sketch comedy in this country.
Well, improv, if you go to see an improv show, it could be awful.
Yes.
So that becomes a very hard thing to monetize and sell. But a sketch, you can rehearse. You can perfect it. So by the time it's ready for the world, you have something you can feel confident saying, okay, enjoy this. And in fact, most of what Second City is. Most of the Second City shows start out as improvisations, which are refined over time and over time. And so by the time you finally get to a Second City show, you're seeing more of a diamond.
So then what's better, a fantastic Key and Peele, you know, or SNL sketch, or an improv show live where the highs are high and the lows are low?
For me, I've gone higher in an improv show when it works, because you're finally dealing with some ineffable metaphysical thing, which is, how did this all happen? And that is a level of, that's just a level of human experience that straight drama takes a little, doesn't necessarily get to.
You write about the improv theater that happened the night after JFK was assassinated. Was it funny?
No. Yeah. And that's okay. It was angry. The story was, Del Close was on stage taking suggestions.
Another legend of improv.
That's right. And one of the suggestions that night was the assassination. And why shouldn't it be? That's what everyone was living. And Del Close shot back something angry at the audience, which is not a technique that a lot of people would feel comfortable with today. But it was Del being true in the moment. And that seems to me like... A healthy interaction. So that's one of the things that improvisational theater can give us, is absolute conversation amongst, like I mentioned earlier, the audience and the players. We are talking back to each other live in the moment.
Well, let's talk about the downsides of being true in the moment. Del Close sounds like kind of a jerk to me. And does improv mean saying the first thing that comes to your mind? And what if that's offensive?
Well, Del was actually, ironically, one of the purveyors of a thing called slow improv. Now, he came to this later than the Kennedy assassination, so it took him a lot of, well, figuring this out before he came to the idea of slow improv, which is, you know, second thought, best thought, third thought, best thought. That it's not necessarily about speed, it's about taking your time. A lot of improvisers, they can fall into the trap of just being fast, thinking fast is good. But Del later on said, wait a second, slow down. And I really think slow improv is really exciting because it also lets in an emotional moment that you don't always get when you're doing fast, sticky, jokey improv.
But so, then aren't you censoring yourself as well, for better or for worse?
You could absolutely make that argument, but you could also be saying you are playing that character who has the capacity to think.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't he be thinking at that particular moment, just as a real person would be going through their first, second, or third thought?
I ask because I enjoy watching improv, but I have been in audiences where, and I understand, you're trying to get a laugh in that moment. Sometimes what people's reaction is to punch down, to say, if you're going to say the quick thing, you're probably going to say the obvious thing, which means you're probably talking, babbling in stereotypes and cheap laughs.
Can be bad.
Did you find that? That's true about improv,
yeah? Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. And the same goes for the audience members. I mean, how many times have an improviser gotten, you know, stripper? How many, porn star? How many times? I mean, you know, so yes, that goes both ways.
But should you never lecture an audience? Should you never say, what's wrong with you with that suggestion?
I think there's no nevers. I think that's the beauty of this thing, because once you put rules on it, you're not in the unknown.
I ask because, we keep seeing men lose their jobs for being unfiltered. And I don't know, maybe we need more improv skills at work. I know a guy who taught a colleague taught a workshop called Improv in the Workplace.
Yes.
You know, it's like maybe we need to be better at improv and have better instincts for what's the right thing
to say.
Well,
it's applicable to everything. It's applicable to art, obviously, that's what we're talking about. It's applicable to psychology, which we touched on. It's applicable anywhere there are groups of people, because the fundamental thing that Yes And teaches you is just how to be good and how to recognize the other person that's sitting across from you. So wherever there's another person, improv is a healthy, nutritious, nurturing skill to have.
Yeah, it's not just people saying the wrong thing. I hear straight white male comedians especially complaining that, oh, I can't joke anymore. Who's the person who doesn't do college? Jerry Seinfeld doesn't do college campuses.
He doesn't.
Yeah,
I'm so down on my stand-up having been.
Yeah, I know. You're in a rarefied world.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that, oh, I can't joke about race, I can't joke about sexual violence against women, you know, I should be able to joke about anything I want. Is there, you know, how is minimizing people, which sometimes happens, how's that good for our democratic back and forth?
Minimizing people? Well, I don't think anything should be off limits as a joke.
Nothing. You joke about anything.
Oh, absolutely, because you never know who's going to find what funny. You know, you might be insulted by something I think that's totally benign, and vice versa. So when you're going out there and looking at your audience and everybody is coming in with their own stories, the minute you start saying one thing is appropriate or inappropriate, you could find that you're closing yourself off to your entire audience. And just as improvisers have to be free to say anything, audience members are also free to say anything that they want. It's a conversation.
But the ultimate would be if the people, powerful people, you know, white guys like us, that if it was hilarious and uplifting at the same time, right?
I think when you're saying has to be, you're putting us into the known, and we have to go out into the unknown. That's the only place that we're going to transcend what we already know and discover what's new.
We have to go into the unknown. That's Sam Wasson, who's going to be at Jet City Improv in Seattle's University District. That's at 7:30. And you're going to be talking with the Jet City Improv founder, Andrew McMasters.
Right.
Yeah. Who knows what you're going to come up with?
We don't know. This is improv.
Improv Nation is the name of the book. And the subtitle is How We Made a Great American Art. Sam, thanks for this.
Thank you so much.
KUOW is The Record. Back in a moment.